Welcome, Impactful Parents. It's time for the Impactful Parenting Podcast, where I give you parenting tips and resources to make you a more impactful parent to your school-aged child. I am your host, Christina Campos. Welcome, Impactful Parents. Today, we're going to talk about an inclusive new approach to gifted education that does a better job of meeting kids' learning needs. Hello, my name is Christina Campos. I'm founder of The Impactful Parent, and I help parents of school-age children turn their chaos into connection with their adolescent. I offer free parent education videos every week. I offer online courses and coaching. And if that wasn't enough, I bring experts in other fields onto the Impactful Parent stage to teach you even more. And today I have a special guest. Her name is Dr. Donna Matthews. Now, Donna is a developmental psychologist and author. She has worked with children and schools since 1990 and was the founding director of Hunter College Center for Gifted Studies. Her work has been published widely, so I am very happy to have her on the show today to teach us more about gifted ed. Thank you for being here.
Pleasure. Thank you, Christina.
I wanted to start off with the question of what is this new approach to gifted education that you're talking about, and how is that different than how gifted education is being taught right now?
This new approach is what I call it is the optimal match approach, because it's all about matching each child's learning opportunities with their abilities. Now, you have worked in gifted ed. You know that a more typical way to approach gifted education is to identify some kids as gifted, leaving everybody else as not gifted. And I've certainly worked for a long time in this field, and I've seen that. I've seen some of the advantages of that approach, but I've worked with enough kids and families to know there are lots of disadvantages too. So it was that my own personal discomfort with seeing what happened in families where, for example, one kid is identified as gifted and one isn't. And I mean, there's a whole lot of issues here.
There's a lot of stigma that comes with that. And my experience working with gifted children and even having my own gifted children is they don't actually like that label. They don't like being called gifted because it sets them away from the main pack. And although they want to be a different part of the main pack, they don't want the label.
Yep. No, I 100% agree with that. It's sort of this optimal match approach that has sort of emerged out of sort of my own work as a clinician, but then also from the emerging research in neurosciences, which, you know, I'll get to that in a minute. First of all, I'll tell you what this optimal match thing is. It's just very simply, it's about matching each child's learning opportunities with their abilities, right? In a given area at a given point in time. So an example that I can think about many that I've worked with that might fit this is a child might be advanced, highly advanced in one area or another, say math, because that's one of the easiest to measure. Highly advanced. So she's in grade 3, but she's functioning at, let's say, grade 9 level mathematically. That little girl is going to be getting into trouble in math class in grade 3 unless something is done to challenge her appropriately to her interests and abilities. She's going to tune out, disengage, or she's going to start causing trouble. You know, something's going to happen either internally or externally that's not healthy for her and certainly doesn't support her ongoing learning. So where that goes, sort of when you think about it collectively, as you understand that this little girl that I just described is not going to be the only kid in that classroom or that school that has that kind of discrepancy between their abilities and what's being asked of them typically at school, is that there should be a wide range of learning options available to meet kids' different learning needs at different points in time. So this optimal match approach is inclusive because it works well with kids with all kinds of different abilities, including those with multiple exceptionalities. It's also inclusive across race, across age, across culture. It's a simple matching of abilities with instruction. So the concept makes sense to every parent, every kid, which is not true of that gifted label and the whole sort of gifted enterprise. That is problematic, as you have said, and as we both experienced. So it doesn't depend on kids. This optimal match approach doesn't depend on kids getting divided up into those. These are the gifted, these are the not gifted, those categories. I think your kids and other kids you've worked with and that I've worked with have resented the differentiation, the segregation. You know, they recognize innately that they are really the same as other kids. Maybe they can learn faster or easier in one area or another. So they may have different learning needs, but they're still human beings altogether. Dividing into categories is problematic for a number of reasons. So this approach is sort of grounded in the neuroplasticity research that shows that intelligence develops with opportunities to learn in a context of interest and motivation. That's true for every child. It also incorporates the growth mindset perspective of welcoming problems and failures as opportunities to learn more. I mean, one of the concerns with a gifted identity, so some kids get the label and then they see themselves as special and different because they are gifted. One of the byproducts of that can be an avoidance of high-level challenge, because the kid doesn't want to fail. They need to have successes in order to feel that they merit that label still. Okay, so the growth mindset research is really compelling in showing the importance of avoiding the label gifted as much as possible and instead focusing on the learning process. And that's where the optimal match idea comes from and works. It's not about me as a special human being, like really smart. It's about me having different learning needs right now. So it's a different thing in terms of the psychological development for a child. This optimal match approach, it's flexible, it's dynamic, it responds to you know, current knowledge about the domain specificity of learning. Each of us has different domains in which we learn more easily and we're more interested, engaged. Now that can change over time. So the idea, so the traditional perspective on gifted is that if you're gifted, you're gifted in everything. The reality is there are some people who are really good at a lot of things, but most of us have a profile of abilities that's pretty variable. Right?
Absolutely. So what I hear you saying is that this new approach is really kind of shifting a mindset on how we look at gifted learners. And it's throwing away the label of gifted and really more focusing on learning differences and how we could optimize the learning differences by accommodating the different levels that people learn at. Is that correct?
That's so well said. Yes. It's exactly what I was trying to say.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah. So it's a shift in mindset. So it's not necessarily a shift in how we're teaching the kids. It's a shift in how we're talking about them and how we're labeling. Yep. And in turn, that's going to affect actually quite a lot, because the psyche, the expectations. Yeah. I completely agree that once kids have a gifted label, a lot of perfectionism starts to come into play because they don't want to lose the gifted label. There's now a higher standard that they feel like they have to live up to. That's so much pressure for them. By not labeling them gifted, my hope would be that you alleviate some of those things that teachers see in the classroom, well, and parents too, see all the time with these brilliant children that don't have, the pressure just doesn't have to be there anymore. They don't have to be brilliant in everything.
Yeah, they can enjoy learning, you know, from this this optimal match mindset, and as you say, you're absolutely right, it's about a mindset difference. They get back to what led them to be gifted in the first place. They love learning. They're curious. They're engaged in learning. They want to learn. But what happens too often, as you said, is they lose that once they've got the label because they've got something to defend, something to lose in if they experience failure or setbacks.
So how do you intend to implement this new way of looking at gifted education into the masses?
Okay, it's such a good question. I don't know. At this moment in time, it's an idea. And it depends on, you know, it's built on so many ideas, like Joe Renzulli's school-wide enrichment model is part of this concept. Joyce Van Tassel-Vasquez's work with the integrated curriculum model could inform, again, it is a really useful part of understanding how to implement an optimal match perspective. From my standpoint, it's an idea, it's a perspective I recommend to parents and teachers to think about. Now, I've been talking about this for decades now, actually, and have worked with several schools now that are implementing it. And sometimes they're implementing it already because they've had a visionary principal or, you know, a very active parent advocacy group or something has been in place. The philosophy, the culture of the school is inclusive. It sort of has created this optimal match perspective. One school I know of that I've worked with for several years now started off with a more traditional perspective, but started encountering and then wanting to respond to the learning needs of kids who had multiple exceptionalities, gifted plus something else. And so that sort of erodes the categorical model. Well, is that kid gifted or isn't he? You know, he can't be learning disabled and gifted. Well, actually, you can be. So some schools get to it sort of organically like that. And now I'm starting to work with schools that are intentionally taking this perspective and working to implement it. So, and yeah, I did for quite a long time. I was involved in teacher development. And so it's a perspective I've been talking about. I haven't been calling it optimal match for a long time, but I've been working with graduate students who are teachers or becoming teachers. And I get all kinds of reports about teachers getting excited about implementing this kind of an approach in their classrooms and finding that their own energy for teaching gets reignited because what they're doing is seeing the parents and the kids and their colleagues as collaborators in the learning environment, the creation of this range of options. So, you know, there's an infinity of options that I've seen schools implement as they encounter situations that need to be addressed, like a kid whose learning needs aren't being well met. Well, you know, that like the kind of kid that I described a few minutes ago who might be in grade 3 and needing grade 9 instruction. One way I've seen of dealing with that is pulling together within a school a number of kids with high-level learning needs, gifted learning needs in, say, math, but it could be science, it could be language, it could be any subject area. So you pull together a bunch of kids from different grades and find some teacher or parent or retired teacher. There's somebody who's willing to work as a mentor with that little group of kids and talk to them about, okay, how do you want to continue your learning? Clearly, this little girl, you don't need grade 3 math, but you do want to continue to learning about math, to learn about math. So what do we do with you? And so you get these little groups forming where there's collaborative problem solving about how to approach it. And you get kids entering contests, working together on projects. It's highly variable.
I do like the idea of changing the mindset to meeting the child where they're at, no matter what their learning needs is. Because when you start looking at it in this new viewpoint that you're speaking of, it really also includes kids that we call with learning differences right now, which is really learning disabilities. Yep. Is what they used to call it when I was in school. But yep. Now we don't want to say disabilities, but now it's the entire spectrum. Now you're just meeting kids wherever they're at, and they're not necessarily segregated by a label. I do like that concept.
Exactly. That's one of the big benefits of this optimal match idea.
Yeah. So my question to you, for those of you, my audience that's watching this and they're new to gifted ed, at what age does a parent or a teacher see that the child might be gifted or might have some learning differences that are just not at age level? They're not going to fit the box.
It can happen as early as the child is interacting with a teacher or other children. So it can happen at daycare that you'll see a child is terribly out of sync in terms of what they need and what is normally offered for that age level. I mean, you know, you get little kids who are two and they're reading proper books. Obviously, the next 3 years, 4 years of reading readiness is going to be wasted on them. It's not going to be interesting to them. So you can get kids very little showing up with gifted learning needs. And again, sort of organically, just observing children's curiosity, their interests, their engagement, their activities, what they're doing. And then it can happen. You can get a kid who goes along all the way from primary through into high school, and they seem thoroughly normal. They don't seem to have any gifted learning needs whatsoever. And all of a sudden they'll take off in music or biology, or there'll be something that just captures their attention and they zoom. And they have a gifted learning need that should be addressed at that point. So it can happen anytime. I mean, I've seen kids, one of my kids, it was university before she, you know, the fire lit and she started, you know, she'd been a kid who just was really B's and C's through high school. And then at university, she became an award winner because she just got excited about the subject areas. So anytime.
I love that. And I rarely hear that from people who are familiar with the gifted ed space. I feel like I hear much more of, you're either born with it or you're not. And not that it could be ignited. And I'm going to use that word because it's not developed. It's really like ignited. Like it was always there, dormant asleep. And then something sparks it like a fire. And then they become more motivated, intelligent in that particular area. And when that happens, they do have a learning difference. They need to learn in maybe a different way with more stimulation than the average person. And so I love how you framed it like that. And I just don't hear that often. So wonderful. I think why it's so personal to me too, is I actually see my oldest son that way, who was born with, I'll say dyslexia, born with, because I don't feel like he developed dyslexia. I think he was born with dyslexia.
Yeah. Yeah.
And his whole life I've called him my gifted child that's not gifted, because he wouldn't hit the gifted, when you get them tested. And I was like, but everything that I see from this kid, and I know gifted kids, is pretty gifted. And then finally, in high school, he hit a subject. And again, I felt like that same thing happened. Something blew up inside of him and lit him up. And now he's an exceptional learner. It's pretty amazing. Oh.
That's so beautiful. I love that. I've seen that too many times, not to trust it. I mean, that's individual developmental pathways is one of my mantras, that every one of us is on our own individual developmental pathway, and it looks different. So the emergence of giftedness can happen anytime, from very early And it can truly be dormant. You can have a kid. In fact, it's interesting. There's very interesting research on adult giftedness and interviews with people who as adults were extraordinary high achievers, like Nobel Prizes and all of that, that the vast majority of them did not show up as gifted until they were at university. They made it through elementary school and high school with nobody thinking they were particularly unusual or smart. Like, you know, the story of Albert Einstein. I mean, he's one of those who didn't show up. Nobody thought much of him, apparently, academically. In fact, many of his teachers did not think well of him at all until he got to graduate school. So
it happens.
It happens, exactly.
I'm curious to know, a lot of gifted schools and actually gifted programs also, they only do testing around, let's say, the fourth grade, give or take a couple years. And I'm curious to know from your perspective, at what age should children get tested for giftedness so that they can get their needs accommodated?
Yeah, I mean, it's an important question, right? It's the best approach is ongoing testing, sort of the people talk about the day-to-day diagnostics in a school or a classroom where a teacher has an understanding of this optimal match approach. They're looking for signs of a child having gifted learning needs, just as they are looking for kids who are going to have learning problems or learning differences. They're vigilant from the time school starts, you know, from pre-kindergarten right through. They're paying attention to the possibility. So that's on an informal kind of a basis. I think it's also wise for schools to look at using the academic achievement testing that's done and see if, like, for the kids who are the very high achievers in sort of by domain, so they're really like at the 99th percentile, 98th percentile in the language areas, say, like, those kids, you want to take another look at whether they're in grade one or grade 10, you know, whatever, wherever they are along the way, those very high achievers may well, like, you don't know the difference when you get a kid functioning at 98th percentile in grade, let's see, when do they usually start, grade two or three, the standardized testing. So whenever those start, take a look at the top two or three percentile. You don't know whether you've got kids in that area who are just really well placed at their current grade level. They're just extremely good students for whatever grade they're in, or are they 10 grades ahead? You know, the tests themselves aren't designed to distinguish between the good grade level achievers and like the kids who have gifted learning needs. So by paying attention to, from the beginning, the kids who are doing really well and looking for the range of possibility with those kids.
And if I have parents out there who are just thinking, is my child gifted? I think so. They seem to be reading early, or they seem to be asking yep. too many questions, or, you know,
yes.
have some sensitivities that maybe other kids don't have, you know, focused curiosity on one subject, and they do that for a long time, and they kind of know right. that their kid doesn't fit the normal box. Yep. What do you suggest for those parents? Just quickly, like, maybe a few things, not only just what I just mentioned, but like a few things to look for if you think that your child might be gifted, and then a next step of what they might do after listening okay. to this interview.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the step number one is doing what you just said, pay attention to your child's curiosity. That's always a good thing for a parent to do. You want to support the development of your kid's giftedness pay attention to their curiosity. And then the next thing is to make sure you give them opportunities to engage in the area of curiosity. So you provide the kind of learning challenges sort of informally at home, to the extent that you can. You do that yourself so they can continue to learn in those areas informally. But then you also look for ways, you think about whether or not that curiosity, that potential area of giftedness, is being supported at school. So one of my strongest recommendations to parents always is look at your child's teacher as your friend, as your collaborator, because teachers, my experience of teachers is they care as much as parents do about supporting kids' optimal learning. They want the kids in their classrooms to be happy, engaged, and learning. So look at your teacher. And I mean, a lot of teachers, unfortunately, don't have the time, energy, or support they need to show that they're that energetic about their child, the children's learning potential. But that's why they're in teaching, because they do care. And so think about the ways your teacher, your child's teacher, might be a friend, a collaborator. Do some problem solving together about how to meet your child's learning needs. If that's not enough, if nothing changes and you feel your child's area of potential giftedness is not getting stimulated the way it ought to be, if they're not getting a good match of curriculum to their learning needs as you see it, then my recommendation, and again, I've seen this work really well with parents and schools, is see if you can find some school people, like teachers, other teachers, maybe including your kid's teacher, but maybe not. Maybe there's a special ed resource teacher available. Look for parents who might have similar kinds of concerns. Get together and see what you can do to think about changing the school culture to make sure that kids' learning needs, their gifted learning needs, are going to be well met. So look for ways to sort of infiltrate the school culture by maybe getting involved in starting a range of learning options to meet gifted learning needs. Yeah. And culture change happens. I've seen it happen just from that, from one parent saying, my kid could really be learning more here. And they end up making a difference.
Yeah, that's where it starts. Usually one parent saying, I want to see something different.
Yeah, for my kid. Like that's how, exactly. It sounds so impossible, but
yeah. And if you can bring some other kids along with you, then that's even more impactful because
it's a more powerful way of getting change too. Like you're more likely to be listened to if you've got two or three or five other parents who are feeling the same.
Yes. Well, tell us a little bit about your book and how people could get a hold of it.
Well, sure. new book just published, Being Smart About Gifted Learning. It is the third edition in, so the first one, Joanne Foster is my co-author on this series. Our first one was called Being Smart About Gifted Children. And back then I could talk about gifted children. I wasn't terribly comfortable about it, but the next one was called Being Smart About Gifted Education, which I'm good with, but I'm even happier with this, Being Smart About Gifted Learning, because I think it's broader and it sort of, it's more engaged in the whole world of opportunity and possibility of learning for kids. So in this book, what we do is we talk about all the things you and I have been talking about, but in a whole lot of detail. So there's three chapters on assessment. How do you know if a child has gifted learning needs? Here are some of the ways, you know, that are traditionally done. Here are some of the issues with those ways. Here are some of the benefits of them. So it's a whole lot on assessment, on some of the science behind thinking about an optimal match. So supporting the kinds of things we're talking about here. And then there's quite a bit. It's a big book. It's 470 pages or something. So it's just big. There's a lot on actual programming, like what you can do in the classroom or at home to support gifted learning needs.
And who's the audience for that book? Is it parents? Is it educators?
It's both. It's both. I mean, yeah, the previous editions have been used as teacher education, you know, in teacher education courses as a textbook on gifted education or gifted learning. But it's a lot of parents. This one is more geared to parents than our previous two. This one, we've done a lot more on homeschooling because that is a growing thing. And I think education generally has a lot to learn from homeschooling. And of course, this optimal match idea, a lot of people who do homeschooling is because they want to provide that kind of a match for their child.
Yeah. And there's definitely a big shift to homeschooling this year since
recent events. So.
Well, thank you so much for being on today. I really appreciate you have so much to offer people. And if you, audience, would like to become a more impactful parent, please check out all that my website has to offer. I have parenting courses, family coaching, 30-day challenges, and lots of free resources. But until next time, you got this, parents. I'm just here to help. Thank you for listening today. Remember to subscribe and share this podcast with a friend. And don't forget, the Impactful Parenting Podcast is an extension of the Impactful Parent community. So go to the Impactful Parent website and sign up for a 30-day challenge, browse the free resources, or register for the weekly newsletter so that you don't miss a parenting tip that can help you and your family. Thanks for listening today, and go to theimpactfulparent.com. See you next episode.